So welcome back, everybody. I am Lynn Gilliland. This is Lessons from Leaders. And I am super excited today. We have Jada here, who's the CEO, the president and CEO of Mercy Corps. And she just happened to come back from a trip from Somalia. So while we probably may not touch on that, she is carrying that in her heart right now and in her mind. So welcome, Jada. Thanks for making time to be with us.
No, thank you for having me.
And just to start with, you have a different background or a somewhat unusual background for CEOs in the global development sector. And you told me a little bit about how you shifted into this sector. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I entered the workforce planning to have this really great career in business and corporate America. And I kind of, my parents were both public servants. It wasn't, so I was fascinated by business and like the scope and control of large companies. I interned at GE before high school. And at that time, which is crazy now because GE is basically like a dead company, but at that time, GE owned NBC, it owned an investment bank, it had this huge credit card label portfolio. So I really jumped headfirst into the world of business, starting as a consultant at McKinsey & Company, just eager to understand how business shapes society and vice versa, and eager to get all the tools and learnings from it. And I really thought I'd be there forever.
And then what happened?
One of my clients at McKinsey was an agricultural company. And then I went to work for them for 2 years. And I realized I really liked implementation and operating things. But I also just came to understand the importance of Africa, the importance of agriculture and lower income economy. So I was really interested in it, but also still feeling like that wasn't my comparative advantage. And then I heard about the Gates Foundation getting going in agriculture. And between McKinsey and my ag sector, I was able to locate some people that worked there. And before I knew it, I was taking a huge pay cut and moving across country to think about how smallholder farmers could access markets. So in that way, it was an opportunity where I could apply my business skills and understanding of the private sector to just do something very meaningful and to explore a passion. So I felt really lucky to do it. I had no idea where it would lead me. I probably assumed I'd go right back into private sector at the end of it, but there's something really magical about being able to try to work with communities at scale in that way that has just kept me in this area of work ever since.
I did not know about the agriculture bit, and you don't know this, but my master's is in agricultural development.
Really? Yeah, there's so many things that I wish I was aware of when I went to college, and areas or avenues of pursuit that I would have had. And I really found I'm a food security geek at heart. That's what I call myself. And so even sometimes my husband comes from a rural area, and he has friends who are farmers, and I'll just like ask to go visit their farms when we visit his family, just as out of curiosity as to what's going on and what's going on in U.S. agriculture.
I love that. I love that you have that like secret, you know, you're a CEO now, you're leading a company, but an organization, but in your heart, you're like, really, agriculture's the thing.
And there's nothing in my background that would indicate that I would have ever come to that conclusion.
That even makes it more fun. And so you have the unusual, the trifecta or the trisector background of public, government, private, and now nonprofit. And I was curious, and still am, how that informs how you lead. Like, what's that sauce look like?
Yeah, it's an incredible sauce. The late great Sam Dryden, who for a time ran the agricultural development sector at Gates, when Obama was elected and an opportunity came up for me to join the administration during food security, he said, "I think everyone should work in government at least once." And I wasn't sure I believed it. My mother was actually a career federal government employee. And so I took a risk, and I have to say, I'm so glad I did it. I really learned the most and grew the most as a leader during my time as a political appointee at USAID. And I add the political appointee part because when you're a political appointee, what my mother told me coming into the job was, she was like, don't do it. They'll just wait you out, right? like they'll have no incentive to work with you. And I feel like you really have to learn how to manage a very diverse set of people. You have to learn how to get people to work with you or how to get people on your side. You have to learn how to move resources and people and systems that aren't necessarily transparent. And the other thing is, you have to learn how to be comfortable with conflict sometimes as well. And so I grew tremendously as a leader during my time in government and public service. And I also really had an understanding for how kind of how the development projects that I was funding at the Gates Foundation really looked on a macro scale, and how country, like just the macroeconomic context of the work that we were doing. And so then from there, I went into, and government also reaffirmed that I love implementing, that I really wanted to be in an implementing organization. And so from there, I went to the NGO sector in various COO roles. And I really do feel, I feel very fortunate to have the combination of experiences I have, the business experiences. You know, Mercy Corps is almost a $600 million organization. You know, it is not a small venture. And I think the business skills are really essential to thinking through the complexities of managing an organization like this, and understanding systems and markets and how it all comes together. But also, you know, what our largest pots of funding or governments, government actions impact the environments where we work. They impact our ability to work in them. And so my ability to understand how those systems work in the U.S. And I also had a glimpse of how other how they work in other countries from my U.S. government experience has really helped me to bring like a full perspective to the work, and to think about all the different levers that we can employ or use to hit our goals. And so I think it's been really valuable and advantageous to me. And I highly recommend people get multi-sector experiences in their careers. It also just helps you to understand how to translate things and how to explain things to different audiences. And you also see a lot of things in one sector that are easily applicable to others. So I think it really helps in terms of my mind being able to integrate things and take lessons from different things.
So I can envision, like, because you have that big breadth of experience, that you can see, draw on those, maybe not even know that you're doing it, and put things together that other people may not notice.
I think that's right. And also just to understand kind of some of the root causes or the intentionality behind things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when someone says, oh, we just need to convince donors to do this, speaking about USAID, and I'm like, okay, but you also need to convince legislators too, because they, you know, they directly control those things that USAID does. So just thinking through the whole, being able to think through the whole ecosystem, and also just understanding like the different levers to pull and the motivations behind all of those different things. It's I think it's been invaluable, and I've drawn on all of it, and I draw on all of it regularly.
It also seems to me, and I might be going a little bit on what you and I talked about earlier, I might be pulling from that, so you can correct me about what I'm going to say if I get it wrong. It feels to me like this is a new wave. Is that right? I don't know if it's a wave, but a new branding, a new flavor of leadership, that you have that background, that you bring that all together. Plus, you are younger than many of the current leaders.
Yeah.
Plus, you're an African American. It's less that you're a woman now, because that's pretty common now. But those other things that you bring are also... I guess I'm aspirational that this is a new flavor or a new breath,
you know,
of wind that's coming in, or
I certainly hope so. I think part of the reason that I've been able to advance more quickly is because the different sectors have allowed me to play the translator role. So when I first got into government, it was like, oh, can you help us with our private sector strategy? Or going to the nonprofit, oh, like, what do you think about advocacy and how do we think about this? You know, I hope it is the case, and I want to do everything I can to make it the case for people from different backgrounds, both personally and professionally, to end up where we are. I think the thing that gives me pause on that a little bit is it's one of those where you have to influence boards. So there's still some boards of organizations that are just looking for like pure fundraisers and CEO roles, right? And or only measuring CEOs by how much they're growing. And so, you know, I think fundraisers need to understand the importance of like that multidimensional leadership and the different audiences. And then there's still a lot of work to do in our own sector around who we advance, who gets promotions. Because when I look at the leadership pipelines underneath the CEO level in a lot of organizations, including ours, those pipelines are not as diverse as they should be. So I hope that we are on the cusp of something, but I know there's a lot of work to be done to really realize that vision.
Yeah. It makes me think of when President Obama was elected. I thought that was a new chapter. It didn't turn out to be a new chapter. So I hear what you're saying. You know, maybe we can't rest on our laurels, so to speak. The other thing that I'm taking from what you're saying is, while you may come in, I'm using you as a case study, as like your ideas from the three sectors you've worked in, your perhaps different vision from your own background, your own way of seeing things, you still have a board that you have to work with, which different boards are going to be flexible, able to see the vision. And then you also have the organization that has been chugging along in its little path.
Yes. So
this is not at all about Mercy Corps. I don't know
this is right. And my reflection on boards is actually stems more from my experience with past employers than Mercy Corps. But I think that's right. And it is all those different dynamics. And I think we have to think about board leadership and board composition in different ways. You know, I think the traditional nonprofit way has been to fill boards with donors who may or may not understand the work very well. And I think I've just, one of the reasons I was really attracted to Mercy Corps was it has a board that was a really good mix of both, and Mercy Corps board members. They love visiting programs. They really care about the issues. But I think that care also led them to have, you know, obviously fundraising is still very important to me, and I think I'm doing pretty well at it so far. So it's not, but I think my board understood a bit more about what leadership in this sector may require. Than just like their job being to help us raise money and to make sure we're growing. Because growth is like the easiest metric for people to see that. And if you are from a corporate background, like growth is the thing. You're thinking about growth and market share. And I think my board in the hiring process understood that it was also about how we work in communities, how we develop trust and partnership, how we motivate our employees, and lots of other things around that.
So in some ways that you may not have been chosen if you had a different board, they might have been looking for someone that was different than you. So I'm trying to match.
They might have just been looking for someone who was like a former CEO of some private sector that they thought could just run it, or someone who just was like this huge fundraiser in some context that could just come in and get money. And, you know, all the biases, you know, hiring involves natural biases. There was one organization where I worked at, as the COO, And one of my employees, he'd been at the organization 20 plus years, I said, well, obviously, like, I'd love to be like the next CEO or a candidate. And the person said to me, oh, you couldn't do that. And I was like, what? And he said, and this is an organization that was very good at raising funds from private donors. And he said, you know, the board needs to feel like they're talking to someone who's like them, like who's from their social circles, like that donors like talking to people like them. And it was one of those situations where someone said the quiet part out loud. And it really, I mean, I'm still really disturbed every time I think about it. And I remember vividly that conversation, and this was not that many years ago. But you know, there are unconscious biases involved, I think my board's fantastic.
Shout out to the Mercy Corps board. And your story about the fundraising, I had many, 2 years ago, we had the woman who was the chief fundraiser for Oxfam on, also African-American, and she had similar stories, and she was just like, just watch me. So anyways.
Yeah. And like, there may be channels open to me or other things that maybe aren't to other people. Or one of the things that my board did when they undertook the CEO search, I know that the CEO selection committee of the board, they took like a mitigating biases class together before starting the CEO search process, which I had not heard of a board doing that before. And I think that was a great practice.
That is good. And I'm glad you said that, because that's those kind of things I want them to be permeate around.
Yes.
I'm glad that you shared that.
Yes.
You and I had also talked earlier, shifting topics a little bit, about, you talked about leading across generations and how that was important to you. Can you speak to how you're thinking around that and what your vision is?
I've learned so much, and I think it is one of those, you know, I don't remember what my generation is, but or I'm bad at the generation names, but I know even on text messages with friends, they'll be like, these millennials or these Gen Xers, and the reality, what I've learned, you know, especially during COVID, in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement and other things, the younger generation was really pushing and agitating for like change right now, which I thought was great, but also for different ways of working. And I just learned to dismiss it would have been at your own peril, right? And it really stuck with me, just like the very different ways of thinking that they were bringing to the table, and that my gut instincts were from a different age, and realizing things don't have to be that way, and really navigating across that. So I feel as though I've learned a lot, and I've learned to be more open. And also, I think it helps me to think about, well, things don't have to be that way. But also, if you look at the work we do in general in this sector, most of the countries and the places where we operate are dominated by young people, right? Like 60-70% of the population's under the age of 18. And so I think it's important to really have a grasp on where things are going and what's important to people. And even though the cultural context may be different, I think really understanding those ways of thinking and intentionally surrounding yourself with them are really important to prepare your organizations for the future. At the same time, too, just dealing with helping other employees who maybe have older generations or different navigate that as well is part of making sure that we keep kind of lessons learned and benefit from their wisdom. But it's been a bigger dimension in my leadership than I had ever anticipated it would be, and it is fascinating.
So say more about that. How has it been a bigger dimension in your leadership?
You know, I have, I think during the George Floyd Black Lives Matter moment, the thing I loved about the way this generation thinks about it is, when I was raised, my parents, I think my generation, we heard, you have to be twice as good at X to get the same treatment because you're Black. And the thing I loved about the kind of posture of where things are is that this generation is saying, I shouldn't have to be twice as good as anybody to get equal treatment. Like, I should just get equal treatment, and you shouldn't presume things. And it is, it's just, I realize that that's generationally a different thing. And I love it. And it just made me think of how I think about the arc of progress and the timeline. Another good example is at another employer, I had a colleague who was in fundraising, and her son was really into this YouTube guy called Mr. Beast. And so there was a fundraising partnership with Mr. Beast, and it was like brought in this whole new audience of people to the organization. And now my kids are 7 and 9. And just a few months ago, my 7-year-old started talking to me about Mr. Beast, right? And it was like just that connection, and even thinking about fundraising as finding YouTube influencers and working with them versus direct mail or even like an email digital strategy. It's like this whole next layer of things. And I think having employees across age spans and being able to understand that is really important, to being able to understand how to communicate who we are and what we do, and bringing new people into these concepts of philanthropy or of creating a more equitable and just society. And I think part of the job as a CEO is to really like pull together lots of levers in service of our mission.
And I would imagine that it requires you to be open. You allude, or what I thought you were alluding to is like listening, being open.
Yes, I think that is right. I'm in my close circle, I have a chief of staff who's a few years younger than I am, but her mindset very much represents, you know, what I see sometimes in that, and I listen really closely to her, and on certain things, and just where, especially around what's going to be perceived as fair or not fair, or it's really important that I think you listen to people, because the sector and the workplace is always evolving, and as a leader, it's not just what I believe is the right thing or my values. It's really understanding like what matters and what's resonating to your staff.
Is there some tension between listening to the staff and hearing what matters and keeping the plane on the trajectory it needs to be on, or is there ever? Yeah.
I think sometimes the biggest thing I have to refrain from sometimes is making excuses, you know, especially younger people in the workforce, like they just maybe not understand all the complications behind something, or why, like, you know, the different ways in the system, or like, okay, maybe that's not legal, or I know that you think I should like publish every name of every person who's ever been accused of anything, but like maybe they, you know, there are privacy things. There's also like, what if the person's innocent, God forbid? And so that you know, but it's a back and forth, and being able to talk about those things. And there are also sometimes where like, I may just think something's from Mars or just like completely crazy, and just having to hold it and think about it and to keep asking like, what am I missing, or explain that to me, or, you know, just going back. But I have learned not to be dismissive, to really listen. And I think when I've seen leaders who've just gotten out of touch or who've really lost the trust of staff, I think it's because even if you don't always agree with someone, understanding what's important to them or understanding the different lenses through which they may be viewing a situation is really important.
Yeah, I'm writing that down, because I think understanding what's important and understanding their lens means that you can speak to it even if you don't.
Exactly.
And then people feel heard. They feel like heard.
And I think there is understanding too how different it may be, I think inevitably leads to increased transparency, because I always try to convey the rationale behind decisions, because it, you know, understanding some of these differences has made it clear to me that like people won't, the assumptions that people will make around why decisions are made, like you should just explain that so you don't leave room for error or misinterpretation.
So my thing is, in the absence of information, people will make up something, and they will make up something negative. It's not, it's just the way our brains are wired.
It's so, totally ambiguity. As someone said, ambiguity is always interpreted negatively.
Yeah. So you want to be chucking as much information.
Yes.
To that
yeah,
space.
Yes. Yeah. And at least like, at least I also hope that by understanding the thought process or the decision process, people also, like, it helps them figure out how to get to yes with me, but it also helps explain, like, the, you know, the richness of our organizations and the different layers of things I'm thinking about in my head or that I need to think about as I make decisions that seem very obvious to some.
And I want to also say that all of this sounds easy peasy, and it's not easy to do. And when you have so much else on your plate and so many decisions that have to be made, it's sometimes not you yourself, but it's sometimes hard to remember to slow down, do that process, listen, because mostly when you, by the time you're a CEO, you're like, make one, the habit, and the what you're rewarded for is make decisions, move on, make decisions. Yes. So it's not easy to do this. Is not, it takes mindfulness, it, I would imagine.
It does. And I actually remind myself, I said a piece of advice that I've given to employees a few times is, like, the more senior you are, the less talking you maybe should do sometimes, because you can take so much oxygen out of the room. And like, as you're growing in your career, you're differentiating yourself by saying, hey, look at me, I'm smart, I have the answer, right? Like that's like that skill of being the talker is the thing that probably got you to this position of leadership. Right. But that once you're the leader, you know, you've got to listen, because you've got to understand, and it's really dangerous when you start making presumptions based on your own experience. Good. So there is something, but it takes effort, and it takes people. Like the other day, actually, my chief people officer said to me, you know, like, maybe like next time in that conversation, like, you should be like the last person that speaks. And it just, there had been silence, and so I felt the need to fill it, and he's right. And I was really glad that we have that relationship where he would give that advice.
Yeah, that's what you want in your executive team.
That's exactly what I want.
So let's talk about courage. What has courage got to do with being a leader?
Yeah, courage has a lot to do with a leader. One, I think there's some degree of personal courage that all leaders have to have to even step up to say, like, hold me accountable for this, right? But in our sector, you alluded to the fact that I've just come back from Somalia in the last few days. And in our sector, I realize a lot of our teams, especially an organization like Mercy Corps, where we tend, a lot of our countries or contexts have a conflict element to them. You know, our staff are courageous doing very courageous things every day, and often in different territories. So you have to really think of them. But I think, I have an expanded definition of courage, right? Courage is, it's taking risk, but it's also a willingness to be wrong, a willingness to make mistakes, a willingness to admit that you've made a mistake, a willingness to talk about when you're not as strong as something and you need help. And I feel like that's all really, really important. The other thing that people say is, if you are coming in to make a change, right, or if you're driving something in a certain direction and no one is upset or ruffled, then you're really not making change. Like, you're really not moving anything around. And I repeat that with some hesitancy, because I don't think the goal is to, like, oh, I'm upsetting someone, I must be doing something. Well, I don't think of it that way. But I do think there has to be a courage in really trying to move the status quo and thinking through how to do that and how to do that successfully. Because sometimes what got you to the point of greatness that you are isn't the thing that will take you to the next level of that. And so, and I think that's very true for organizations and especially mine in our sector. I think we just have to constantly be looking to innovate or to be more efficient or just to even adapt to different circumstances and the way the world works.
What I like about, if you're not making people uncomfortable, with the caveat, that's not the goal. That's a sign that you are going, perhaps pushing toward the edge or beyond, and innovating. And especially because, at least for my, speaking for my own self, you know, having been socialized that I'm not supposed to make anybody uncomfortable ever.
Yes.
So that's like, so stepping into leadership too, it's, again, it's not about you, it's about what you're trying to create. And one of your signs is some people's feathers might be ruffled.
Yes. And yeah, what you just said too about never making people uncomfortable, like really moving past some of those gendered things or just cultural things that make us think a certain way or attribute. I think that's a huge part of even just the whole inclusion and diversity conversation is recognizing like certain things may not be comfortable, and it's not because someone's too quiet or whatever. There may be cultural reasons, and really being clear to think past like how people present themselves, or making sure that the most talkative, outspoken person in this very Western way isn't the one that's always rewarded. Like it just goes right, much deeper, realizing that we're all bringing such different things and assumptions and backgrounds into our work.
Yeah. And then you're just touching on culture, another favorite topic, what's getting rewarded around here. But we'll make a note to touch on that. I wanted to ask you, what do you love about your job? I'm just getting the sense that you're like, I don't know, like you're just like, oh, this is not always comfortable, but you do love it.
I do. I love my work. And I really came to love Mercy Corps quite quickly. I think it's really, I feel very fortunate to be able to wake up every day and think about how do I create like a better society, or how do I help to enable someone to reach their full potential. And at the end of the day, I think that's what everyone that works at Mercy Corps is trying to do, right? They're trying to enable communities to like, and people in them to live their best lives. But I love the diversity of it. You know, like one minute I'm in a meeting about the Ukraine, the next Somalia, the next maybe our office in Edinburgh. And I really do get great joy out of people and just different quirky personality types, or understanding people's motivations. And I'm an introvert, so that's kind of weird, but I do, and I need time to myself to regroup. But I do find engaging with lots of different people to just be really fascinating, and like it really fulfills my soul in some ways. So I love what we do, and I would love for the world to have less of a need for what we do. But I want to make us like the smartest and most efficient and most effective at what we do.
And Mercy Corps is already at the top of the game, so it'll be very cool to see where you go, where you take it next. For me, so my last thing I would want to know, or that I'm going to take time, because there's lots more I could talk to you about, which would be, what advice would you give your younger self?
You know, it's such a funny question that you asked, because there's so many things that happen day to day that I'm like, gosh, I wish I knew this before. Manager, right? Like sometimes I have employees who are just certain they know what happened, and I'm like, you have no idea, but go ahead, I can't talk to you about it. I guess the advice I'd give to my younger self would be that learn as much as you can, but also believe in yourself and believe and really know your values and the type of place that you want to be. Because I've found in my career that the times that I've been miserable or that weren't good were places where my personal values didn't line up with that organization's. And I think when the values don't line up, you don't have a pathway to really affect change or to make a place comfortable for yourself. So I would just really like, you know, to my younger self, I would say like, really like understand your values and hold on to them, and you know, and in situations where there's not a match, it's not that you're the problem. It's that that's just not the environment for you. But learn what you can and keep moving.
I like that. And it's so important because I think especially when we're younger, we think it's us.
As
opposed to this just isn't a good fit.
And I think when you're maybe a woman in a predominantly male environment, or you're an African-American, when there are a few others, it's like, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing? And it really, it's not that.
Yeah, let's put that down. Let's hand out cards and say, it's not you. It's just not a good fit.
Yeah, it's just not a fit. So,
well, Jada, I have so enjoyed this time with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for doing this podcast. Like, leadership can be a very lonely endeavor. And it's nice to listen to your interviews with other leaders. Like, it helps to feed my soul. So thank you for what you do.
Oh, thank you. So thanks, everyone. And we'll see you on the next episode.
Bye.